Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website, whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also click a link and download the PDF file, which is the actual worksheet process itself. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process and or they've called in with powerful testimonials about how the use of that process has improved the quality of their lives and their relationships. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you click on it, it'll let you download an app that contains a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads to comments, questions, or testimonials. And if you have any of those for us, give us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number and press 1, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code and turn on the microphone. We greatly appreciate whenever people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work, and the intention with this work is to be a service. So how can we be of service to you? How can we help you? What's on your mind today? How has it been for you to have us working through the way of mastery and dip our toe into lesson 4 yesterday near the end of the show? We had our support group last night. I don't even know if I mentioned it yesterday, but it's a Tuesday, so as in most Tuesdays, we had our Mind Shifter support group. and that the blessing of those groups is beyond words. We had somebody actually work through a worksheet last night as a benefit to the whole group, and somebody who was quite emotionally overwhelmed with everything that was going on in her life. And so another group member decided she would grace us by stepping through the worksheet process as a way to demo its benefits and its process. I should also mention I was trying to put in the chat room today, but the chat room isn't malfunctioning today. But I was trying to put in the link to the talk I gave, or the webinar kind of presentation I gave last Thursday night about grief and loss. And I finally got the link to that today, and I will put out an email that has that link in it and the password, so anybody who wants to watch that webinar can do that. Second half of today's show will be a replay of something in behalf of Michael and Jeannie, who are occupied elsewhere. So it may be a day or two before that gets posted in the show notes, but I will eventually make that information available to Jeannie, and she'll post it in the show notes for today and tomorrow, I'm sure. So we've got time. We've got, as usual, about 50 minutes left to talk about the Way of Mastery in Lesson 4 or something else, if there's something that somebody wants to bring to the table and have us discuss. So remember correctly, yesterday I just got started in Lesson 4. And for me, it was at first when I started presenting this work to the Mindshifter support group, which has now been running for 18 years. When I first started presenting that, this was one of the more challenging chapters. Lesson 4 and Lesson 5 really made people's heads spin. The title of Lesson 4 is Following the Thread of Desire. And we're picking up on the second page near the top. The second paragraph on that page says, the goal then of genuine spirituality is to realign the quality of your perception to mirror, to resonate with, to be in perfect alignment with the perception of your Creator, to see with the Creator's eyes. And this is, you know, sidebars, that was something that was mentioned in Chapter 3, where it said, the greatest gift I could ever receive would only come to me if I could learn to remove any perception that was less than the shimmering radiance that underlies everything. The greatest gift I could ever receive would only come to me if I could learn to see life, see love, see the unfolding of creation the way the Creator itself sees these things. And so here we are in Lesson 4. It repeats it and says, the goal of any genuine spirituality is to realign the quality of your perception, to mirror, to resonate with, to be in perfect alignment with the perception of your Creator, to see with the Creator's eyes. Beloved friends, in truth, you remain as you were created to be. This means that in each and every moment, you are literally using the power found in the silent depth of the ocean of the Creator's love that gave rise to your very creation and existence to perceive as you desire. So the same energy that gave you your existence, that created you, is the energy you use to create your perception. So this goes back to talking about how your mind energy is a creative force. It is always on. You cannot turn off your mind energy. You can't help but be creating every moment. What you do have dominion over or choice in is where you focus your conscious awareness, the kinds of thoughts you're choosing that you're going to create in alignment with. You're going to create more sadness if you focus on sadness and loss. You're going to create more bitterness and hurt and anger if that's what you focus on. You're going to create more joy and bliss and aliveness if that's what you focus on. And the energy that you're using to create in that way is the very same energy that the Creator used to create you. Now, this ought to boggle your mind a little bit. This ought to shake the rafters, because this is not what we're taught by most religions in the Western world. We're taught a different kind of humility. We're not taught the humility that's from the ancient Aramaic that says, humility is the ability to look for and see the highest and best in another, to see that shimmering radiance of the essence of the creative energy, of the love of the Creator, behind the picture your mind shows you. Humility is the ability to see the highest and best in another, to see their true nature, and then, regardless of what they're saying or doing, choose to cooperate only with their highest and best, with their true nature, with that shimmering radiance of the creative energy, of loving energy of the creation expressing through them. Most Western religions teach us a humility that is, we are less than, we are unworthy, we are sinners, we could never, you know, imagine communicating directly with the Creator. But the humility that comes, the meaning of the word humility that comes from the ancient Aramaic, is the recognition of the truth of life, the truth of your brother and sister, the truth of yourself, that shimmering radiance, and that what you're doing to choose to perceive, whether you choose to perceive them as another being of brilliance and light, just like you, who's either acting from their awareness of their true nature as this being of brilliance and light, or they've either temporarily forgotten or yet to discover their brilliance. You could choose to view them that way, or you could choose to put a negative filter on it. And you can create a perception of them as bad and wrong and demon spawn and all of that. You can choose that. The highlight of this paragraph is to say, the energy that you're using to create that perception, whether it's a bitter, angry, hurtful perception or a blissful, loving, gratitude-filled perception, that energy is the same creative energy that gave rise to you and your awareness, that your Creator used to create you, and that you're using to create your experience of life in each moment. And that, if you sit with it, if you observe it, that is a game changer. The third paragraph on that second page of the fourth lesson reads, therefore, in this lesson, we will address the very nature of desire itself. We will address what it means, what it signifies and how it creates effects. We will address the power of desire, the value of desire, the meaning and purpose of desire, and how to begin to bring that energy, which at times feels like a team of 1,000 wild horses all wanting to go in their different directions, to bring that energy under your conscious and deliberate direction so that you might create as the Creator created you, that you might create with perfect, deliberate, and infinite love, with perfect, infinite, and deliberate joy, and with perfect, perfect freedom. So in this lesson, I'm going to read that paragraph again because this is it. This is tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So here it is. What's this lesson about? In this lesson, we will address the very nature of desire itself, this energy of creation. We will address what it means, what it signifies, and how it creates. We will address the power of desire, the value of desire, the meaning and purpose of desire, and how to begin to bring that energy under your conscious and deliberate direction. That energy which at times feels like a team of 1,000 wild horses all wanting to go in their own directions. We're going to do all of that so that you might create as the Creator created you, with perfect, deliberate, and infinite love, with perfect, infinite, and deliberate joy, and with perfect, perfect freedom. The next paragraph reads, desire. When I walked upon your planet as a man, I confronted many different opinions about the nature of creation, the nature of humankind, and the nature of consciousness or self-identity. Just as you are now confronted with many schools of thought, so too was I. While that can seem to lead to great confusion, as though one must choose from the smorgasbord, it actually serves not unlike the sand inside the oyster from which the pearl will come. This causes you to grate inside. You must find your own way to your own truth. Before each and every one of you lies your pathway, a doorway, an eye of the needle, through which only you can fit. So here's the sidebar that's perhaps one of the most important of all our sidebars. Everything about this teaching, everything about Mind Shifters Radio, Mind Shifters Support Groups, the Reality Management Worksheet, everything about it is designed to help you tap into your guidance system, your individual connection to the one mind, your ability to expand your awareness of your connection to the Creator, your ability to be aware of your insight and intuition, your conduit for the creative energy, so that essentially you remove any need and any urge for a guru or a teacher or a master. They say it in a number of different ways. One of them is that the essence of this set of teachings, not just the Way of Mastery book, but all the books, the Way of the Servant, the Way of the Heart, the Way of Transformation, the Way of Knowing, Course in Miracles, all of them have as their goal you being able to birth Christed consciousness within yourself. So here's this little paragraph in the just past the second part of second half of the second page of the fourth lesson. Just two lines. You must find your own way to your own truth. Before each and every one of you, there lies your pathway, a doorway, an eye of the needle, through which only you can fit. In essence, no guru, no master, no teacher, no priest, no rabbi can tell you what you need to do to wake up, to reach enlightenment, to reconnect with your creator, to tap into your insight and intuition. They can suggest some things, and what they suggest may or may not work for you. You're the one who has to step out onto that bridge that looks like it's floating in midair and isn't connected to anything. You're the one who has to test the truth to see if it works for you. The next paragraph reads, therefore, in some respects, you are seemingly alone. You must make the decision to desire, above all things, awakening into perfect remembrance of your union with your Creator. This is the only thing that's going to bring you home. You desiring that reconnection, that awareness of that constant connection. You must make the decision to desire above all things awakening into perfect remembrance of your union with God, with your Creator. This is stated the way it is very intentionally. This isn't reconnecting. This isn't finding God. This is awakening into perfect remembrance of what has always been true. You might eventually get tired of hearing it, but this text says over and over again, the truth that is true always. It always was true. It always will be true. What is that? You remain as your Creator created you to be. You are in instant, constant connection to the forces that created you and that can teach you. They will never abandon you if you just ask to be shown. That paragraph goes on to say, just as a wave might finally decide that it has been birthed not to be fearful of being a wave, but to truly claim its individuation, its uniqueness, and to live that fully. And in that fullness, it decides to discover a way to be aware of its infinite union with the ocean itself. It decides to somehow break free of the myopic self-identification as one little piece of wave that arises in a place or a field of time that lasts for but a second and then disappears. That's not what a wave is. A wave is just an aspect of the greater whole. But we can choose to see ourselves as this tiny little self-identified piece of a wave that arises in a place or a field of time, lasts for but a second, and then disappears. That's not the truth of ourself. It's a false perception. We can create it. Our culture assists us in creating it, pre-programs us to create that. But the truth is that you are connected to the infinite ocean. You are rising from it and infinitely connected to it. The next paragraph reads, just like the wave, you can decide to find a way to transcend limitation, to become re-identified with a consciousness, a living awareness that you are one with the depth of the sea. decide that you can operate not from the superficial level of awareness that might be like the foam at the tip of the wave, and you call that your conscious or egoic mind, but that you can become informed in all that you speak, in all that you do, in all that you create, and all that you perceive. You can be informed by that which rests in the very infinite depth of the ocean itself. Substitute the one mind, the Christ mind, the mind of the Creator, for the ocean itself. Imagine then, the next paragraph says, imagine then drawing upon a well within you that seems to have no bottom and no sides, through which something is pouring forth from places unseen, in which your literal conscious attention or awareness seems to be colored with radiant light. A light that literally leaves you feeling that you are not the body, mind, or the personal history with which you have identified before. This is an awareness that those things are only temporary and very impersonal effects of a level of desire within your soul, which is one and the same thing as the love of God, the love of creation expressing itself. For no other reason than that love must be extended. It's the nature of the creative energy to extend. Imagine, the next paragraph says, imagine transcending your fear and your own survival, of your own survival, because as you look upon your body-mind, you're no longer identified as that body-mind. The body-mind has become a tool to be utilized by the love that rests in the mind of the Creator. You live, yet no longer you, but Christ dwells as you. This is a very real experience to be lived. It is not just a philosophy. It is not just a concept, and it can never be a dogma. There is a mystical translation that occurs in the depth of the soul, which is merely a shifting of where you perceive your sense and source of identity. What is the energy required to take you from the myopic self-contraction in which you have become identified with the little drops of foam on the tip of the wave that are tossed to and fro by a power that seems to be outside of you? What is the energy required to take you from there to a sense of identity with the silent depth of the ocean that is everywhere present and seems to know no beginning or no end? What is that energy? The very energy that will carry you from the tip of the wave to the depth of the ocean is the energy of desire. The next paragraph reads, for I say unto you, if God had not desired to extend love, if creation wasn't by its very nature an extension of creative energy, always moving, flowing, and giving rise to more, you would never have come into existence. Your very sense of awareness of self is the result of the effect of love, capital L love, the creative energy extending, expanding. So I'm going to go back to the beginning of that paragraph on page 43. For I say unto you, if the Creator had not desired to extend love, you would never have come into existence. Your very sense of awareness of self is the result. Capital L love, the energy of creating. It is the very same love that has birthed the sun and the moon and all of the stars and every dimension upon dimension upon dimension of creation. That very love, that very energy of creation, that desire to be extended is the very source, capital S, source from which you have been birthed. As you know yourself, you are the effect of God's desire to extend love. And here comes one of my favorite parts of this entire 35 lessons. When next someone asks you, who are you? Please, do not give them a name. Do not say, well, I was born in a certain town or in a certain part of the planet. Do not tell them that you are a Democrat or a Republican or a communist or an atheist or a Catholic. Tell them the truth. Quote, who am I? I am the extension of love in form. I have never been born, and I will never taste death. I am infinite and eternal. I shine forth as a sunbeam to the sun. I am the effect of God's love, and I stand before you to love you. Now that will raise some eyebrows. It will also transform your world, for it is time to stop seeking Christ outside and start choosing to take responsibility for being Christ incarnate. So there's something that'll rock your world, right? There's the idea that in the beginning of the second page, the goal of genuine spirituality is to learn to realign the quality of your perception so that it mirrors, resonates with, and is in perfect alignment with the perception of your Creator, that you learn to see with God's eyes, in other words. You are the effect of that energy. And so here it's restated in the bottom of the third page. Who am I? Somebody asks you who you are, tell them the truth. I am the extension of the creative energy in form. Some people call it love. In truth, that essence, that energy that created me, has never been born and will never taste death. As such, my essence, my awareness, is infinite and eternal. My essence, my awareness, my true being shines forth as a sunbeam to the sun, extending the love, the creative energy into form as a sunbeam extending from the sun. I am the effect of the Creator's love, expansion of loving energy, the extension of the creative force expressing in form, and I stand before you to extend that energy to you. I stand before you to bring the presence of the conscious, active presence of the awareness of that love into your presence, to show you your true nature, to be the mirror for you, so that I can mirror, resonate with, and be in perfect alignment with your perception of yourself the way your Creator would see you. Now, the fact of the matter is, when you get to the point where you're willing to say that out loud to somebody, it will transform your life, transform your world. And it will cause some ripples, sometimes laughter, sometimes hurt feelings, sometimes claims of blasphemy. That will happen. I have had it happen to me as I've shared that passage from this book. Depending upon the group I'm with, they love it, and they want me to say it again and teach it to them so they can write it down. Others laugh at me. Others get angry because they think that I'm saying that I am God, etc. Get all kinds of responses with that. It's kind of like a Rorschach test. You can present the ink blot to people, and everybody's going to see it differently based on what's in their mind that's getting stirred up. So if we don't have any hands up, I'll continue. The next section is titled, Desire is Everything. The text reads, take a moment right now and let the body relax. Imagine that you can move back from being the actor in the play of your life to being the director and the producer. You're sitting in your studio and you're editing the story of your life. You're looking at all of your little clips of film. Clips like the time you were birthed, the time you went to kindergarten, the time that you first fell in love, the time that you first decided to go to a movie, the time that you went off to college, or the time you took a job, this job or that job, or the time that you moved to another physical location. Look closely and see if it is not true that for every action you have ever done, for every decision that you have ever made, after trying to analyze it all, is there not underneath it the energy of desire? In truth, you do not lift the body from your couch to go to the refrigerator without the desire to eat. Something calls you into an expression of action. That something, it is desire. No one enters into an intimate relationship without the energy of desire. For what two have ever looked upon one another and said, quote, I don't feel any desire whatsoever, but let's get married, have children, and raise a family, close quotes. Desire is that energy which brings forth all waves of creation out of the depth of the ocean itself. So this might be important. Here's a definition of desire. Desire is that energy which brings forth all waves of creation out of the depth of the ocean of life itself. The next line is critical. And yet who among you has not felt conflicted about desire? Who among you has not been taught that desire is evil? Who among you has not been taught not to desire to be great? Who among you has not been taught that the desire for material comfort is some sort of a blot on the spiritual path? Look well within your soul and see if this is not true. Have you not feared at times the welling up of desire within you? For as I look upon your plane, there are many who become paralyzed with fear just because they desire to have a bowl of ice cream. So afraid are they that if they give in to that desire, something in the ice cream will cause their body to bloat and their brain to cease functioning. For those of you in an intimate relationship, marriage or commitment of some kind, how many of you have not carried the belief, taught to you by the world, that if you feel an energy of desire welling up within you when you look upon someone who is not your partner, that somehow you've sinned against God? How many of you do not know the experience of trying to rein in the 10,000 horses, so sure that if you give in to feeling desire that everything would run amok, and that your attempt to keep your life structured, rigid, and predictable would collapse and, quote, all hell would break loose? Yet I say unto you, would you exist if God had feared the desire to create and extend love by forming you, at the same time giving you infinite freedom of choice? Without desire, look around, because without desire, not only would you see nothing, there would be nothing to do the seeing. Everything is the effect of desire. To back up a few paragraphs, desire is that energy which brings forth all waves of creation out of the depth of the ocean of life itself. So this is probably why, having read this chapter probably several dozen times before I brought it to the support group, when we had somebody have a very strong negative response to the beginning of this chapter and feeling triggered and upset and wanting to argue, it's probably why, from the combination of things that I've just read, that I found myself saying, okay, look, you don't like the word desire, so every time in this book where you see the word desire in this chapter, do yourself a favor. Take a breath. Take a pencil or a marker if you want. Cross out the word desire, and in the margin, write this phrase. The energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in this moment. And what could be wrong about the energy of desire that wants, of the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in this moment? Because desire is that energy which brings forth all waves of creation out of the depth of the ocean of life itself. I added life in that, out of the depth of the ocean itself. Page 45, the third paragraph there reads, come then to see that desire is not evil. Everything is the effect of desire. So this paragraph says, come then to see that desire is not evil. It is not to be feared. It is to be mastered. Mastery is not control. So here we have to train the Western mind. The Western mind thinks, you put your nose to the grindstone, and that's how you master something. We have a heading in one of our earlier chapters. We talked about it as kind of the paradox, that mastery flows from innocence. Right? I'm not going to put my nose to the grindstone and master something. I'm not going to use my intellect to think my way through to the perfect answer. Mastery arises from innocence. And here we are again. Mastery is not control. For control, the need to control, is an effect of the energy of fear, not love. Mastery of desire comes when you recognize that you are safe to feel whatever wave of desire might come up through your consciousness, because you decide whether or not you will act on it, whether or not you will bring it into the field of manifestation. The next paragraph reads, the power of choice is the power that can never be taken from you. You already have perfect mastery of it, because nothing you ever experience comes to you without your decision to allow it into the field of manifestation. So, to back up and read those last two paragraphs again, the last line of the second paragraph on page 45, everything is the effect of desire. Next paragraph, come then to see that desire is not evil. It is not to be feared. It is to be mastered. Mastery is not control. For control, the need to control is an energy, an effect of the energy of fear, not love. Mastery of desire comes when you recognize that you are safe to feel whatever wave of desire might come up through your consciousness, because you decide whether or not you will act on it, whether you will bring it into the field of manifestation. The power of choice is the one power that can never be taken from you. You already have perfect mastery of it, because nothing you ever experience comes to you without your decision to allow it into the field of manifestation. The text goes on to say, desire is something that wells up from the depth beyond yourself that can be looked at with perfect innocence and with the wonder of a child. The very act of turning to allow and welcome desire is not something that will sidetrack you from the path of awakening, but it will take you vertically into the heart of God, the heart of creation, the heart of the one mind. For if you are ever to create as the Creator creates, you will need to heal your conflicted perceptions about desire. You will need to transcend that energy of fear. So, to back up, there's a critical piece that's being offered to us that's not just related to this chapter. This urge for control is an energy born of fear, not love. So anytime we feel this urge to control, we know we're not in alignment with the energy of creation, with the view of the Creator. And we, if we are going to learn to work with desire, if we're going to do the exercises that come up in this chapter, we will need to transcend that energy of fear. For the very act of turning to allow and welcome desire is the energy that will take you vertically into the heart of creation, the heart of the mind of God. The next paragraph reads, there are many who call unto me and pray. There is not an hour in your time frame in which there are not many people upon your plane, somewhere on your planet, who are praying to me and want their hearts to be filled with Christ. Yet, at the very same time, they're scared to death of an energy that wants to move through them because they've been taught to fear and suppress desire. Desire is like the liquid of life that moves through the stem of the rose and allows the petals to radiate with glorious color. When you block the flow of desire, the petals cannot be nourished. Death begins to occur. Death of the heart, death of the soul, and lifelessness. If you were to walk down one of your city streets and to truly look into the eyes of everyone you see, would you not recognize that death seems to have already made a home in their minds, at least of many that are still living? Death of dreams, death of hope, death of worthiness, death of playfulness, death of true power, and death of union with their source and creator has already taken place. Everyone who reads these words or hears them spoken has had this experience, and they've seen it in others. Healing requires the willingness to feel desire, to see it as good and to see it as holy, reverent. Does that not mean that if you feel desire, that it might not become twisted by the echoic patterns of your mind? Of course it would. It can. There is always the possibility that desire will be twisted to meet the needs of the egoic mind within you. But rest assured, if it does, who has done it? You. You. Always within you, you have known that desire is good, but you suppressed it. Those times when desire came forth and you let it become twisted into serving the goals of the ego, you always knew perfectly well what you were doing. You were the decision maker. You have learned, therefore, to fear desire because that fear is the effect of fearing yourself. And that is what cripples you. That is what cuts off the creative flow. That is what leads to everything your world knows as the multitude of psychological diseases, unwillingness to trust oneself, unwillingness to love oneself, and the belief that the desires that move up through your beingness are something evil and dark. You think that if only you could stamp them out of your being, those energies of desire out of your being, you could remain in control, and everybody would like you because you would conform to the smallness and the littleness that is worshipped in human consciousness. Understand well, here's the next axiom we're going to give you, and this will rock people's worlds if they let it in. The only relationship that holds any value at all is your relationship with your creative source. Your relationship with whatever you want to call it, God, light, love, Jesus, Holy Spirit, your creative source, which is the depth of the ocean. That is the only relationship that holds any value at all. And of course, right away the mind says, but what about my mate? What about my parents? What about my children? What about the President of the United States? What about the postmaster? You will come up with a million examples of relationships that surely have great importance. The only one that holds value is your relationship with your Creator. For when that is in alignment, all of your creations, your choices for relationships, and how you will be within them will flow effortlessly from that alignment. Therefore, seek first the kingdom, and all these things will be added unto you. Do not try to create a rose by starting with the petals, but nourish the roots, and the flower must blossom. There's a biblical quote here being tossed into the middle of it. Seek ye first the kingdom. Therefore, seek first the kingdom. And in the biblical quote, it probably says, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things shall be added unto you. Do not try to create a rose by starting with the petals, but nourish the roots, and the flower must blossom. Now, that quote, that biblical quote, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and all these things shall be added unto you. Guy Finley did an analysis of that. And he said, we tend to think that that's a scriptural passage telling us if we do what the scripture tells us, we're going to get all this good stuff. And Guy Finley says, that passage has nothing to do with acquiring a single thing. And he says, here's a better way to think about that passage. If you go back to the ancient Aramaic and the Greek meanings of the words that were used, he says, that saying could be more accurately transcribed as, seek first the rule of divine love. The equitable rule, the balanced rule of divine love, and all of these things that you desire shall be placed in a passive position within you. So when you have this urge to eat, you know, 3 quarts of ice cream, and you seek first reconnection to your source and your awareness that you are the extension of love in form, that you shine forth like a sunbeam to the sun, and that the greatest gift you could ever receive will come when you dismantle every negative perception of your brothers and sisters and the life events that you have, when you do that, all of these urges and passions and lusts will fade away. They'll be placed in a passive position within you. And what is needed for you in this moment to be a blessing to yourself and others will be revealed to you. When you seek first the rule of divine love and its completely equitable or balanced nature, that balance will be restored within you, and the energy of desire will flow through you in a way that will align you with the desire of creation itself. So, we'll end there for today. We have just a few minutes left. Time for a little quick question or comment before we start the tape for the second hour. The call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1 if you want to make a comment or ask a question or make a suggestion. Or we'll move into our second hour, which is a continuing discussion of the Beatitudes. It's the fourth in the series. And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Thank you for being here with us on this journey, and I wish you well until we meet again tomorrow. Blessings.
630, you're on the air. Is this Mark?
Yeah, hey, Jeannie.
Hi.
It's great to hear your voice again.
Thank you. It's good to hear from you. And we have had so many comments of people that have really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you very much for being part of our show this week and discussing the Beatitudes with us.
It's been just such a pleasure. It's I want more and more people to be aware of the gifts that they bring.
Absolutely. Welcome, Michael. Mark is already with us.
Thank you, dear heart, and thank you, Mark. Glad that you're here.
Glad to
and
be here.
I'd like to open the conversation with, do you have any other thoughts to add from yesterday? We kind of ran into a little bit of a time crunch, but...
You know, we could talk for probably a whole episode on each beatitude individually. So we could always expand on it.
Sure.
But I felt pretty complete with Beatitude 6, and I know we're going to move on to Beatitude 7 today. But how about you? Did you have anything that you wanted to add?
No, I think we've got a picture of it. It gives everybody a good taste, and if they want to spend time with that poster, of course they can order one, but they don't need to do that. You can just go to the link in the notes from the last couple of days, and it'll take you right to our website with a copy of the poster. You can go to whyagain.org, and in the upper left-hand corner, click the Start Here button, and just look down the list, and you'll come to where it says Other Worksheets, and the poster is there, so you can print it off and spend time with it. If you want to take it to the next level, you might want to order the book, Enlightenment, which is what we've published so far from the Kabor's manuscript, and that has the first century dictionary, and there's a powerful, powerful experience in going into the dictionary and sorting through all the shades of meaning and possibility. And as I said, for me personally, when I worked on this poster way back almost 40 years ago, I sat down and wrote it out longhand, and that was where the big aha came of this is not just a nice philosophy, which is what I had always been taught, but this really is a set of instructions. This is how to have a sound human mind and live, as, Yeshua said 2,000 years ago, the reason he was here was to bring life, not dogmas and doctrines and all that sort of stuff, not churchianity, but really to take people into human life. And interesting, one of the things we created out of the Aramaic was a course called Laws of Living. unfortunately, we don't have that one yet as a standalone self-study intensive. But when you realize that that word law in Aramaic is not the rule of a superior, as the Greek philosophies would have you believe, but the word law in Aramaic is really just, here's the recipe for how to create something, for how something works. And so the Beatitudes are how to make life work as a human being, you know, like, and in particular, the protocol for how to cause your mind to work as a human mind, which is not, sadly, what the Western world has much of a clue about. So it's pretty exciting stuff to me to realize there's such a clear formula as the Beatitudes gives, a clear set of instructions, and you understand them for really, truly living in a human mind. So the final Beatitude we're going to talk about today is the one that the Greeks say, blessed are the peacemakers, they shall be called children of God. And there's a really big piece that the Greek translation misses in this particular Beatitude, and that is that in the Aramaic words there is a point or two part of the protocol, and that is that there's a component of service here. It's kind of like I've come to understand is, here's my rent for being on earth, for having a human life and being on earth, and that is that there's service to humanity required in this Beatitude in order to fulfill, really bring into expression our full humanness. So in the Aramaic, yuhu, and the word in Aramaic is abde. Through service, work effectively to produce peace and understanding under and in accord with the Creator's will. And if we do that work, if we do put energy into service in order to serve humanity, then what it says is that you will be called, you'll step into a category where you function as the offspring of the Creator, as a child of the Creator, a reflection of the Creator's energy. And this completes the protocol aspect of the Beatitudes for bringing about a true human life. How has that one struck you?
So this is one of my favorites. It's one of those that really had a deep, moving meaning for me, and it's very much aligned with what you're saying. But I'm going to share a lived experience of just kind of how it showed up for me, because I was very much a rule follower. Excuse me. A rule follower as a kid, you know, if my mom and dad said something or a teacher said something, I wasn't the rebel. I was like, okay, I just want to be, you know, accepted and, you know, be thought of well and behave and all those things that were important in our structure.
Right.
And the gap for me was the relationship wasn't always there with why. The relationship wasn't always there with, you're saying that I'm, quote unquote, supposed to do it this way, but I didn't either take the time or what have you. I just wanted to comply. And so one of the things that happened when I had my psychotic break and then started to get into the healing process is this struck me incredibly when I started to get to a place where these inspired thoughts would come through to write, or an inspired thought would come through. For example, obviously you're familiar with, you know, the program that we devised based on the foundation of your tools called Optimal Being. And there was just this desire for that. And the Beatitudes, that's another way that, and I'll share how I got there, but it's another way that Beatitude 7 showed up is, this thrust of insight came that, wait, this is important to me in my developing my understanding, because it really helped me, you know, look at all the different aspects, but then to share it with others, you know, through the Beatitudes practice, which is just what we called it. And what I love about this, if we look at peacemakers, and I'm going to go to J.M. just for a second, just to bring his context in, because the way he had described it is ripening in a new wholeness. And there is such a naturalness to that. Like if we think of a fruit on a tree, you know, the unripened fruit that becomes ripened. And so as we do these early Beatitudes, this idea of peacemakers, there's a refinement that's happening in us. And we get to this place where, as it says, we'll be called the children of God. And I know one of the things that you've done a really nice job of is contrasting the Aramaic and the Greek. But on that last part of we'll be called the children of God, it ties together here. The Greek word, which I won't be able to pronounce because I've never spoken a word in Greek, but I'll do my best. It's like huio. Theo is the way it looks. And it shows up 41 times in the New Testament, and it's synonymous with Christ Messiah, or one who has a unique relationship with God, or inseparable with God, one with God. And the one that I like the best that matched with my lived experience is anyone sharing the same nature as God. And so that idea of being a child of God, it's like, well, blessed are those who do this work, who do all this work and go through Beatitudes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And it's not a one-time thing. Obviously, it's an ongoing evolutionary process. But as we ripen into this new wholeness, as we come into this relationship, we become kind of these channels, as JM says, for new creations that serve the same restoration in others, which I'm not sure how he got there because I don't know his whole framework, but he also studied the Aramaic, and it was like that really resonated for me, that served the restoration in others. And I'd say it this way. It's like there's this joy that comes like, oh, I'm experiencing this overflowing abundance of relationship with God, with these life forces of God, these active, you know, amazing forces that are alive in me, right? And how do I now bring it out in the world and help others find it too? So that was the best I could articulate it right now as to like how it showed up for me, just how my experience was with it.
Yeah, stepping into the thing of service. And a thought I'd like to offer, Mark, because I've heard you claim this before, and I heard you just claim it again, and I'm going to make a suggestion that perhaps it'd be the last time in your eternal life that you do claim this. And you talked about a psychotic break. I don't think you had a psychotic break at all. I think my offering would be you broke with insanity, the ego mind, the Mr. Magoo mind, and you started to bring in the true state of being, which is what these Beatitudes are about. And the world says, uh-oh, that's crazy. How dare you function as a human being? You're supposed to, you know, that story I shared the other day about, you know, the crabs in the bucket. When you put one crab in a bucket, it crawls out. If you put two crabs in a bucket, when one tries to crawl out, the other one grabs it and pulls it back in again. You don't need a lid on a crab bucket. If you got 20 crabs in the bucket and one tries to crawl out, another one will pull it in, another one will pull it in, it'll pull it in. And I'd offer that diagnosis, and if we break down the word diagnosis, a dyad is two, an agnostic is somebody who doesn't know, two who don't know. And oftentimes these diagnoses are simply from the state of the non-being mind, and why aren't you being normal with all these other minds that work in the world of rage and fear and guilt and grief and pain and drama and trauma? You know, come on, get back here with us, because that's how we feel validated. And so I would say you had an opening in your ego structure, something that the world does its best to lock us into, you had an opening in that where truly human life started to show up. That's what, for instance, when you talked about, you know, you'd go into these yoga postures, your structure was saying, okay, here's what you do to open up your antenna so that you receive what you as a true human being are designed to receive. And my offering is that's not a break. That's an opening.
Well, and you're right on, and my I received that, and I would love to find a way of expressing that would help others see what you're saying, you know, with a kind of a clean way of communicating it. But that helped a lot. Thank you. I might come back and listen to that.
No.
And for me personally, by the way, just for people listening, I had kind of, and I don't think this is necessarily ripe yet, right? I think what you said is much more ripe. I had come to, you know what, the world talks about these situations in a way that they talk about these situations. And so in the medical model, they would look at the things I went through and say, yeah, it's a psychotic break. In my life experience, it's like, it's wonderful. I'm so glad I had that quote unquote psychotic break. I mean, that was
a healing
crisis. The breakthrough that was needed for me to fully come online and have a life, you know, my before and after pictures, if there was a photo
exactly
that could illustrate it, which it can, because it, you know, the surface looks pretty similar, but if it could reveal the core of a human being, I think what you'd see is the before picture would be someone who was on his deathbed, and the after picture is someone who has risen into new life. And it's such a contrast.
And risen is a good word.
I like it.
That's
too.
The real resurrection. You know, if you realize that people who function out of a mind with hostility or fear active, Yeshua referred to those people. There was one guy who lived in that world and said, man, I want to follow you. And he said, but I have to go bury my parents first. And it was a man's, in that culture, it was a man's job to stay with his parents till they died and literally bury them. And Yeshua was like, well, wait a minute. If you're going to follow me, you're going to step into life. Let the dead bury the dead. Let the blind lead the blind. That's not where you're going to go if you're going to follow me. Now, you are going to get to take up your cross. This process of healing is not a Dr. Feelgood thing. It means we're going to go through the quote-unquote craziness of the non-being mind and have to work through it, and it is a work. I was on the phone this morning. We have a young lady in England. Actually, it was kind of interesting because she shared that, or she had written to us and said, I want to start a book study on your book. It's like, great. So my first question to her when we talked said, yeah, well, of course, we'll support you with that. My first question was, how did you get a hold of the work? How did you find out about it? She said, well, I don't really know. Somehow your book showed up ordered from Amazon. I didn't order it, or at least I don't remember ordering it. I don't know why I got it, but I start doing these worksheets, and it is profoundly life-changing. And since I had my quote-unquote, what the world might call a health break or a psychotic break, about 5 years ago, this young woman, she looks like she's maybe 30 or so, she had a brain bleed, and as a result went blind and clinically died. And she called it a near-death experience. And, you know, if you're already dead, you can't have a near-death experience. If somebody is dead to the truth of who they are as love, as created essence being called love, then they're already dead. That's the first death. And if clinical death occurs, you know, the self that isn't the non-being self, the self based in hostility or fear, the one that Yeshua said, in order for you to live, you've got to die. That self that needs to die is a self based in hostility and fear. When clinical death occurs, because that's a product of Adam, Adamos, the red clay, when clinical death occurs, that self is collapsed. It's gone. And that's exactly what the Aramaic forgiveness process does, is it collapses that non-being self each time one engages in forgiveness. And when that non-being self is in a non-div state, one gets a chance to experience who they are. And this woman spoke about how after she had this brain bleed and she, quote-unquote, died clinically, all of a sudden she's like, I started to see things. I started to understand things that didn't make any sense. And as a result of that, she changed her career and started to work with supporting people in having a near-life experience. And somehow or other, she said, you know, the book just showed up from Amazon without her ordering it. At least she didn't remember ordering it. And she started reading and started doing worksheets, and she's just, you know, moving her life forward. She said, I'm going to bring this into my book study club. And she'd started the club after she had this near-life experience where she clinically died. After she had this brain bleed, this stroke that led to a brain bleed. She had a break
quite
with the non-being self. And everybody that has this near-life experience comes back, and they've had a chance to experience themselves as who they are without reference to the carbon-based memory, fictitious self. And some people I've run into kind of have some, you know, sort of partial memory of that, but they never did anything with it. But most people, their lives change dramatically because even though they don't know it's what they realize that's not who I am. And they struggle and work to try to bring into expression in their lives who they really are, and that's the work of Yeshua. Again, Yeshua's stated purpose was, I come to bring you life more abundantly, and to bring forward the full expression of human life that pre-brainwashed self generational pattern of hostility and fear has to be defeated, has to be taken apart. And most of the world functions in that self. And so anyone who's, you know, crawling out of the bucket with the diagnosis gets pulled back in. And so I just support you in, you know, never referring to the diagnosis again as something you own or belongs to you or really has anything to do with you. It's called awakening. It's classic.
Yeah. I think you helped me see that one of the reasons I use it is for inclusion, because if I were to say to certain audiences that I had this awakening, you know, I thought, could be incorrect, that I might lose people who would kind of say, okay, well, this is going into, you know, it could be for some people like, okay, this is going right where I want it to go. And for others, it could be, okay, this is going into, you know, kind of woo-woo-ville. And so I learned over the years, which I'm willing to unlearn, to use that kind of to include people in and then open up and dismantle it further in the, once they're in the door, if you will.
Right.
But
well, and if you're talking to somebody who's had that kind of diagnosis, still use it as, I could see where you might still use it as a tool for others who've been given that same, you know, to who don't know diagnostic name. It might be a way to talk to them and coach them out of that into the truth of what happened to them. And the world doesn't know how to handle that. I can remember working with a woman back, this goes back probably 30 years ago, and she was actually referred to me by a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, she had come to him for a second opinion. She'd been under the care of a separate psychiatrist, and he was getting ready to put her into long-term asylum because she was clinically crazy. And in order to do that, they had to have a second opinion to force her into that. And so this psychiatrist is someone who knew of my work and referred her to me. And when we uncovered her memory of her, the image in her mind of being a child, and I don't remember exactly what age. If I remember correctly, it was maybe 5 or 6. And standing with her father at the in the front of a an asylum, where her father was pointing out to her mother in a window way off in the distance, who had just been put into an asylum that she never came out of. When she uncovered that memory and the pain of the loss of her mother being taken from her that way, she went from, you know, the reason she was going to be incarcerated just like her mother was because she'd become non-functional in her relationship with her husband and her family. She had no relationship left with her kids. Her husband had left. They were, you know, divorcing, and, you know, she was quote-unquote crazy. When we went back through still point breathing to that moment where she had this just deep, horrific pain of losing her mother and remembering just seeing, you know, the little picture of her up in that window up there where Dad said, well, you know, Mom's gone now. Within about 3 weeks, the other thing was that she had lost her job and couldn't hold a job down. Within about 3 weeks, she was back to work. She was back in full-blown happy relationship with her husband. Mm. And back in relationship with the kids who were so estranged, you know, like, we need to put Mom away. When we uncover the things that lock us into this non-being space of hostility and fear and are able to embrace them and process through them, then the thought disorders that take us out of the world's way of doing things, oftentimes are the vehicle into living as the truth of who we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can take a thousand different forms. It's as variable as there are people.
And that's the key for people who are listening too, who are doing this. It's like, it's, and some of you I know have been doing it for a long time, probably longer than I have, but essentially it does show up how it needs to show up for us. I'd love to, if it's okay, before we go to Beatitude 8, or you might have more on Beatitude 7, of course, but before we move forward, I was inspired earlier this year to write about, you know, the whole how mental health, you know, can show up. And my first fiction novel I put out, just kind of mostly friends and acquaintances, called Prisoner of War. And I just today put it up on Amazon. And so it's resetting the price, but today it's 99 cents, and tomorrow and for the next 5 days, I would have made it today, except for the rules on Amazon. For the next 5 days, it'll be free on Kindle. So if anyone is interested and would like to read it, it's a really interesting story that takes place in the future, in the year 2032, but it revolves around kind of mass formation, which is also known as mass psychosis, and a couple of different avenues of how it's approached in the book, one via technology and integration into the body, and another via this work, essentially, but through this main character, Marcus, who kind of navigates his own, what the world would call insanity, but his own awakening process. And it's really quite fun. It was amazing to put this out. So just for anyone who's interested, you know, and is live on here, if you go there tomorrow to Amazon, and it's by a pseudonym author, John Aconda. I just use that for this fiction work, Aconda. So Prisoner of War by John Aconda is out today. So thanks for letting me share that. I meant to, and I apologize, I meant to actually email you.
Yeah, it's cool.
You ahead of time to ask permission, so I hope that wasn't...
No, that's okay. No, that's perfect. That's
free gift for everybody.
All right. Well, we'll download it and give it a listen. Prisoner of War. I'm just looking as we speak. Cool.
Yeah, and it's, and the pricing up there, it'll be adjusted in a few minutes. I think it's still $4 or something. It'll be down to $99 again tomorrow. It'll be free.
Cool. Well, you hadn't told me about that. Well, let's see. There's a book by that name by Michael P. Spradlin, but that's not the book you're talking about.
No, you probably, because it just went out, you probably have to type in the author, John Aconda, to locate it. And of course, Michael, if you'd like, once I get some print copies, I'll ship you a copy.
Cool.
I found that the subtitle of it
said it
was possible to heal from a mental illness.
Yep. And it's still kind of loading. The image isn't there on the Kindle one, but if you click on the paperback, it'll show you the cover of the book and description.
Cool.
Yeah, it's fun
awesome.
To get that out there. And
nice.
As we get
nice.
To the Beatitudes, I'll share some of the things I learned, you know, from the Beatitudes in putting this together. As we go further on.
Right. And
8, 9.
Yeah. Cool. Well, if we look at that, you know, the poster that we did, I only went to the 8th Beatitude because the 7th Beatitude, because it really is the protocol, the instruction set for producing a mind that, rather than functioning from carbon-based memory, what most people call a mind, produces the, what was in Aramaic, you know, they speak of two minds. There's the non-being mind, the mind of Adam, almost the red clay, and then there's what was called the mind of Christ, and the word Christ is usually thought of in this Greek philosophical culture as a religious word, but the word Christ really, it isn't a name, first of all. It's the title of an office. So, you know, if let's say Mark ran for the mayor of Naperville, we would call him Mayor Mark, but mayor wouldn't be his name. It would be the office that he holds. Well, Christ is the name of an office in Aramaic, and actually the word more literally would mean the buttered one. They anointed people who'd awakened to the truth of who they were with oils, butter. And so that word Christ represents living as a human being. You know, Paul talks about the mind of Christ in you. That isn't Yeshua. You know, there was no man, Yeshua Christ, Jesus Christ. There was Yeshua who lived in the mind of Christ in him, encouraging others. You know, it's interesting the church tried to create this exclusivity. He's the only begotten son, the Greeks tell us. Well, if you go to that passage in Aramaic, it doesn't say what the Greek translated as the only begotten. It says the first begotten. Now, somebody woke up to the hour and said, hey, guys, here's how you do it. The things I do, you can do. And when you do, it'll be greater because you'll be living out of literally your birthright, and that is the mind of love in you, the mind of Christ. And so this 8th Beatitude really is saying that, well, you know, people are going to look at you a little strange. So they, Greeks translate that as you're going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. If you're living truly as a human being, the crabs are going to try to pull you back in the bucket. And so when it speaks of the kingdom of heaven, so if you're living out of the community of love, the world based in hostility or fear isn't probably going to like you very much. And so this idea of being persecuted for it, and I think, you know, if back at day one when you had this opening for that mind to start to operate in you, which the world really didn't recognize, if you had support from then, you'd be them, pardon me, for that state way back when it happened, rather than having to wait until we met, you'd be, you know, a whole lot further along the road. So wish we'd connected earlier, but, you know, obviously it was the right timing.
Yes. So can I add to that?
Please, absolutely.
One of the interesting things about Beatitude 8 and 9, so 8 and 9 kind of deal with this idea of, you know, the persecuted, and then 9 goes into the, you know, a little bit of additional thing. And the way that I've come to understand it so far in my practice is that there's this, after 7, right? So 7, and I'll back up a little bit because you had mentioned the Christ piece. One of the things just that I thought when I first kind of went down the track of realizing, like, oh, wait, so this Christ can come alive in us. It's like, you know, the laying down of the non-being, and then there's this risen being, this, you know, the Christ-conscious self, the optimal self, if you will. And I had this thought for a time that, oh, then I'm done. And that's not true. And Beatitude 8 kind of helped me really settle into that. It's like, oh, wait, what 8 is really informing us of, and I love the way, again, JM brought up the word, this persecuted word, in a form that said, move out of your comfort zone. It's like this loving force, this power of these active forces of God are moving through us, and we're going to be moved away from our old habits. We're going to be moved out of our comfort zone. We're going to be moved out of those old habits so that we can get moved back into alignment with that pure self. And
you're going to function as a human being.
Yes. And so what I started to see is, and initially it didn't feel really as good as it did later, because I was in resistance, you know, that great resistor, right? But what happened for me is I would be confronted with these old habits, and there would be inspiration to do it differently. And it was moving through all that was in me. It was going back to Beatitude 1. Even though we're in Beatitude 8, it was going back to Beatitude 1 and 2 and 3, in that to allow for more refinement. And I saw old habits fall away. And there's so many examples that could be shared, but one that I've shared many times that's a real simple story is when I would feel a sense of overwhelm, you know, in my day, I would find that inevitably I'd end up in the pantry. And in our pantry, you know, we still had, you know, crackers and chips and things, and I would end up eating, you know, crackers and cheese and sausage or whatever it was. And then I would feel better, quote unquote better, and go back and attempt to work through whatever it was. So
right.
Over time, what began to happen in Beatitude 8 here, as I started to get to this more refined state, I would find myself moving to the pantry. And it's a walk-in pantry, so I'm standing in the pantry, and I had no action to pull anything off of the shelves. I was just standing there. I remember my wife one day saying, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm not quite sure, but I'm standing here. And what was really occurring is I was being confronted with a habit. And finally, after this happened, call it dozens of times, and each time I'd say, anything for me to be aware of. And that's one of my common phrases, anything for me to be aware of. And I'd just breathe. And sometimes there's this spark of insight. And one day it became really clear. It's like, hey, when I'm in a state of overwhelm, it's because I'm so accustomed to burying that sensation, I would use food and then try to get to a place where my system was calmer. So once
was
that released, yes, it was my drug. Once that released, I was able to navigate overwhelm in much better. And it still took a little bit of time, right? Because then it's like, wait, I'm feeling this. Now I'm aware of it. So it moves from the unconscious to now I'm conscious of it. Now what do I do instead of going to the pantry? And no, now what I've experienced is, in the today reference, if there's a sense that there's something overwhelming, you know, then I go right to the breath, I allow for the emotions, and I allow for my perception to shift from where it is to open up to, well, what else is true? What's really optimal here? And I can stay present, and there's no movement toward, you know, any drug, if you will.
Yeah, that's, you know, when you put it in terms, think back to the intensive where we talked about a healing crisis. And the healing crisis happens when, one, I'm doing more and more of the right things. Think about the time when you found yourself in the pantry. You're doing more and more of the right things. And just before that happens, you hit a new level of vitality. When that occurs, then something that needs to be processed out of the system that's based in usually some form of hostility or fear is going to surface. What the world teaches us to do when those healing opportunities surface is go anesthetize against them. You know, give me a fifth of scotch. Give me some caffeine. Give me some sugar. Give me some white flour. Give me something to devitalize myself and shut this new level of vitality down. I was talking to a physician the other day who had just been through what he was, and this guy's a pretty well-known healer in Florida, and we do a lot of processing, and he's been doing this work for about 25 years now, but he was telling me about how he'd just gone through these horrible symptoms in his sinuses and all this stuff was going on. Man, he was in this big disease process. It's like, wait a minute, John, take a breath. Hold on here. What I hear you describing is you've been doing more and more of the right things. Is that true? Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
oh, sorry.
You took a new, he's actually a supplement manufacturer, and you created this new supplement, and the way his mind interpreted was when he took this new supplement, all of a sudden he said, well, that bottle that I had must have been old and had a bunch of bacteria in it, because as soon as I put it into my sinus just went crazy, and man, I've been sick for 3 days. It's like, wait a minute. No, you haven't been sick at all. And no, you didn't take on a bunch of bacteria. You've been doing more and more of the right things, right, John? Oh, yeah, definitely. You hit a new level of vitality. Man, the day before he said, I was flying high. I felt so good. It was just, okay, so now that you've hit a new level of vitality, your system's able to dig into the next layer of what you need to process through, and you went into a physiological detox with your sinuses, which, remember, that's been one of the places where your symptoms have showed up all the way back from when you were a little kid. Oh, yeah, never thought of that. So you didn't take in bacteria. You hit a new level of vitality, and here you are with what you need to process through. And the culture teaches us to drug ourselves when that happens, and that's a signal that says, oh, I need to keep doing more of the right things rather than head to the pantry. And
well,
allow my healing process
that
to occur.
That is so good. So good. And the shift happens when, instead of someone saying, and he gave a great example of resistance, like, oh, I don't want this, like, this is worse, right? But someone who's more conscious in Beatitude 8 is going to say, oh, wait, something's different, and what did I do different? And so there's, like, almost the maturing of that is to embrace it. Like, okay, I'll use an example of a friend of mine who bought some NanoSoma. I met him, he's down in Texas, and he and his wife started using it. And NanoSoma is this wonderful product that you're familiar with, you might have talked about it on the program, but essentially he started to feel tenderness in his head. And he's like, well, that's interesting. Now he's aware of the healing process, he's a chiropractor, and it healed up after, you know, a couple of days or whatever, and then another soft, tender spot. And he started to connect. He's like, wait a minute. And he had 6 concussions in his life. And as he kept taking the NanoSoma, it went from one spot to another spot, and one of them was actually, he was hit in the eye as a 6-year-old, and his eye finally felt really tender. And then that healed up. And then after the physical stuff healed up, he started to open up to more of the emotional traps that had been there, and
exactly.
That started to open up. So he called and was like, Mark, I just want to tell you, like, how great this is, because he's like, I didn't know this was there. But he had the eyes to see that he was actually moving forward, even though something that temporarily, you know, showed up as, you know, something uncomfortable was appearing in his head.
Exactly.
And that's the idea. Allow yourself to be moved out of your comfort zone. Allow yourself to be, you know, it's like that's part of the process of becoming.
Continue to do the behavior, the quote-unquote right things to keep you moving in that direction. A lot of times when that healing
yes.
crisis happened, and that's why it's been called a crisis, that's when people turn back to their old habits. And there are four things that we talk about, four questions to ask yourself when you become symptomatic, whether your symptoms are a disease process or a healing process. The first question is, have I been doing more and more of the right things? Second question is, had I hit a new level of vitality? Well, then up come the symptoms. I'm symptomatic. There must be something wrong with me. Well, no. Ask yourself the third question. What's happening with your elimination? In a disease process, there's a restriction of elimination. In a healing process, there's an increase in elimination. And then the fourth one is, and this is especially important for people who've been involved in addiction healing, and that is that there will be a craving of the drug that was used when the initial offense occurred. Best example I've got of that is we have a young woman who actually started doing this work back 40 years ago. She met me at a workshop in Michigan, and she's a naturopath, or she's actually written several books on nutritional healing, and it's like was kind of a purist when it came to food. And she sort of abandoned this work and then came back around to it almost 40 years later. She actually was on the radio show quite often during the period of about a year when she was digging back into her forgiveness work. And she called me one day and she said, Michael, I don't know what's going on. I can't control myself. Now, in the naturopathic world, you know, there's an understanding that, like, for instance, if you've got a body that's, you know, a pound or two and you want to build it to a 1,000-pound body within a year, cow's milk is a really good thing. If you've got a body that is, you know, a pound or two in utero, and by the time it's four, you want to have a body that's about 30 to 35 pounds, you probably need mother's milk, not cow's milk. And so in the naturopathic field, we oftentimes, in order to help people to create a repulsion from the stuff that maybe people are addicted to, we call it cow pus. And so, you know, this woman for decades has never eaten ice cream, but she's doing worksheets, and she calls me. She's like, I don't know what's going on. I can't help myself. She said, I'm just eating ice cream by the gallon. I'm just sucking it down, and I haven't touched ice cream in decades. What's going on? I said, well, what are you doing? What's that? Well, I've been working on stuff with my dad and, you know, the abuse. Her father was from the Middle East and was, you know, she was treated as a female, oftentimes as Middle Eastern men treat women, and she was working through a lot of that abuse. And so she shared that and said, well, you know, when dad had abused you and afterward was feeling bad, what did he do? Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
He take me out for ice cream.
Oh, my
goodness. So as a kid, every time, you know, dad abused her, his way of making up was to fill her with ice cream. So here she is, you know, 45 years later, and she's working through this abuse with dad and going back to her old drug, the sugar and the, there's actually an opiate in cow's milk that addicts people to milk, caseal morphine it's called. And the protein molecule ties in with morphine. It's literally an addictive substance. But And that was her, like, you know, we talked afterwards. That was her last mouthful of ice cream. She had no attraction to it whatsoever. But the fourth thing that'll tell you when you're symptomatic, when you're in this state, is there's this attraction to her, this craving for. And my take is because when we take an addictive substance in, the energy signature, if not the actual molecules, are locked away with the energy that we dissociate from, that we stuff down, that we hold the breath around and lock out of view. And literally, when the healing process occurs, we become vital enough to rise above that and process it out. And then those energetic signatures are going to start to move back out of the system, and you can't think of anything else but that. And if you're not conscious of and aware, you know, we've all heard about the guy that, you know, he got his 30-year chip just last week. He hasn't had a drink in 30 years after, you know, a couple of decades of being a drunk. And after 30 years, he falls off the wagon. What happened? Well, he got his 30-year chip, all kinds of excitement and aliveness, new level of vitality. And so what occurs when he's got all that support and that new level of vitality, up comes that craving for that alcohol. And if he doesn't know that it's his body detoxing that old energy signature, then there can be falling back into the addiction. And so each time you go through a layer. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the beauty, you're probably going to say the same thing, so I apologize. It's like the people who do that, whether it's the ice cream or the alcohol, what this beatitude is essentially saying is, as those habits fall away, the kingdom of heaven is yours. It's like you're gonna have this true relationship with that divine mystery that's available to all of us, and there's another level of insight or movement forward in your life toward what's optimal for you. You know, as you talk about with Tuvayun, the whole point is like these are all moving you into your optimal life, your happiness and well-being, et cetera.
You're going to function as you were designed to function, as the offspring of love, because you are love, period. But that's not something that, you know, is very welcome in the crab bucket, generally speaking.
No, and I'll go to the crab bucket next with Beatitude 9, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, go for it.
So my doesn't mean it's right, right? I'm not claiming to be the master expert on this, but my understanding that helped me navigate these Beatitudes was to see for me that Beatitude 8 had a lot to do with my inner, and Beatitude 9 had to do with how people respond to my inner change. And some of the things I put out there, so that blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake, is how it reads in the you know, King James kind of stuff. But what I look at this one is like, hey, when we bring out, you know, in Beatitude 7, when we bring things out, they're going to support other people in finding their path, no matter how that looks. I mean, you could be, you know, building tires and do that. You could do lots of different ways wherever you are in your life and what you're inspired to do. But if you're coming from that and then you're going through this further purification in Beatitude 9 or 8, Beatitude 9 is going to essentially reflect to anyone on this path that, hey, not everyone's going to like it, like you said before. You know, they're going to project potentially on you and attack and even separate from you. Because
they might even give you some kind of crazy diagnosis.
Yeah, they might do that.
Some kind of crazy diagnosis and want to put you away in an asylum.
Right.
Because you're actually functioning as a human
being. And the key is, can we maintain our presence of being while that's happening?
Exactly.
And so just a real quick lived experience, and I'll let you kind of close up on this one. Going back just to the simple example of the pantry. When my wife walked by and said, what are you doing? Right. And she didn't say, oh, hey, sweetie, you know, you look really nice today. It's, you know, with a big smile on her face. What you doing? It was more like, what are you doing with kind of the look of,
what's wrong with you?
You look really weird. What's wrong? And for me to be present, say, yeah, I don't really know, but I'm in the pantry. I'm here. that would be someone in that particular moment who is able to stay present. But if I had responded differently and said, oh, yeah, I was getting some crackers, and I pull the crackers and go back into the evidential mind to try to, look normal, which was one of my big things too. Interesting contrast, right? Then that would be okay, there's some unripeness there in me, but everyone's going to face this. Anyone on this path, you're going to face this, and one of the things I've learned to do is celebrate it. And
absolutely.
I've learned to recognize when someone's attacking, that's off energy, I understand that. So can I stay present and then start to, from that place, invite the active forces of God to come through in the words and the thoughts and the breath and in everything, to know right action at that moment.
And of course, when my perceptual mind constructs an attack from the outside, it's because what I'm now getting the opportunity to process through and heal is all the ways I have attacked myself. I'm projecting that into my brain's image of what they say or do, and, they can say or do what they say or do. I'm only going to interpret this attack as if that resonates the ways in me that I have attacked myself. And it's my opportunity to refine the next level of what goes on inside of me and remove those energetic patterns and live in, now that I'm all the way through the Beatitudes, that latent neural structure the Creator's put in me to guide me to happiness and well-being can come into full blossom, full expression, because I've given up everything that shuts it down. And the last thing to go is going to be that attack stuff. So that someone could stand there and do what the world calls attack, and I'll look and go, that's interesting. Because there's no attack left in me. I've processed through it all. I just stand as the offspring of the Creator, the expression of love, and go, do you need some support? You look like you're really in pain. I'm listening to your voice, and it sounds like there's some stuff going on for you. How can I support you? Rather than, look what you're doing to me. And that's a big one to give up. Like, that's a major piece of work. I'm talking from personal experience. That's a major piece of work to do.
It is. It is. It's one of the hardest ones for me was and I'm not through, again, I'm a work in progress. I use these every day.
We all are, Mark.
And one of the things that Beatitude 10, really highlights is you're going to keep doing this. It's like, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they, the prophets, which were before you, which is in some of the studying I've done, it's like, okay, we're in good company. So anyone who's ever gone through this path of awakening has done these things. They may not have had them written down the way we have them written down, but this is the process of healing. And Jesus gave it to us. Yeshua gave it to us. It's like this, one of the greatest gifts given to humanity is right here in these little practices, which we can find
absolutely.
In all of the tools you teach. You can find the Beatitudes in them. I mean, these things are really, really beautiful. And what it's saying is continue doing this until the last vestiges of fear have been healed. Until you're, like you said in the previous thing, until you can be fully human always. But if something happens to throw off that game, if you will, you got some tools, right, to pull into practice and move back into that human state, the being state.
And the greatest addiction of these, we could put it into that scriptural language, what is the greatest addiction of all? When Yeshua talks about the first and the second and the greatest commandment, what's the greatest addiction? What's the last one that everybody gives up if they're going to actually do the work and give it up? It's hostility. It's such a common addiction that we call hostility an emotion. Hostility is not an emotion. Hostility is an anesthetic. It's no different than alcohol. It's a drug. It's a way, when pain is resonated in us, to anesthetize against feeling that pain. And if I anesthetize against feeling it, I can't work through it. I can't heal it. And so each time that hostility is aroused, you know, to stop focusing on, you know, the pointer to the outer world, look, it's you that's making me so mad, and stop going, here I am. Where is this tightness that locks me into this hostility and has me believe this whole perceptual construct about myself that's false? And to give up that anesthetic, that drug, is what empowers us to go to the last piece of work that needs to be done and reclaim the truth of who we are as human beings.
Well said.
Breathing with you and with our whole audience, and we're down to the last minute. So, Mark, I'm going to just say thank you for participating in this discussion the last few days, and it's a delight to get to interplay with you and capture your experience and bring it into this this whole beatitude practice. And everybody,
such a pleasure. Thank you.
Delighted. Thank you. And everybody, have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. The world needs it. You can give it.